The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
This is Dr. Sharon Berquist, and today we have a very exciting guest. Dr. Cassandra Quave is a curator of the Emory University Herbarium, an assistant professor of dermatology and human health at Emory. She leads antibiotic drug discovery research initiatives and teaches undergraduate courses on medicinal plants, food, and health. She's trained as a medical ethnobotanist, and her research is focused on the documentation and biochemical analysis of botanical remedies used in the traditional treatment of infectious and inflammatory skin diseases. She's also the co-founder and CEO of Phytotech, a drug discovery company dedicated to developing solutions from botanicals for the treatment of recalcitrant antibiotic-resistant infections. She has been featured and profiled in the New York Times Magazine, BBC Focus, National Geographic Channel, and featured on NPR and several other news outlets, including The Washington Post, CBS News, and NBC News. Welcome, Dr. Quave.
Thanks so much for having me, Dr. Berquist. It's great to be here.
Now, I want to start by asking you, what is ethnobotany?
Sure. So ethnobotany can be broken down into two parts. Ethno, referring to people, and botany for plants. So it's really the scientific study of how people relate with plants. It's also been called the science of survival because our knowledge of how to use the natural world is really essential to our survival.
So it includes medicinal plants for the purpose of health as well as food and every application to people.
Absolutely. So it involves plants used as medicine, plants that are used as food, including wild plants. There are many parts of the world where people rely on knowledge of wild plants to supplement their diet, and those also have important health impacts. It also includes the study of plants for tools, for agricultural implements, musical instruments. I mean, any possible way that you can imagine that plants are used, that's what ethnobotany encompasses.
Just using nature.
Yes.
For what it's intended to be used for. How did you get interested in this?
So I've always been an outdoorsy kind of girl. I grew up in South Florida and spent most of my childhood wearing no shoes and running around outside. And so I've always had this pull to nature. But on the other hand, I also had a pull towards medicine throughout my childhood. And so when I first became aware of ethnobotany following studies in anthropology and then tropical ecology, it really just captured my imagination. I love the idea of bringing together these concepts of the way that humans are connected to nature and how that actually can impact our health.
Yeah, I think that's just so phenomenal because nature has so many gifts to offer us, and we really have almost, it's become a lost art of tapping into nature. You know, I think when you look at things more historically, there's traditional medicine. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the way, we became very single ingredient pharmaceutical oriented. Mm-hmm. And I think there's increasing interest now of medicinal power of plants and natural remedies.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, the foundation of Western medicine as we know it today is based on medicinal plants. We've just become a bit more removed from that because we've isolated compounds from those plants and we now synthesize those compounds in a scientific laboratory. But historically, a lot of these are based originally on compounds that were found in nature. The other thing that's important to note is that outside of Western medicine and much of the developing world, around 80% of the population still relies on plants as their primary source of medicine. And so while we don't perhaps see it every day in the U.S., and there are many places in the world where people really rely on their knowledge of nature and having that knowledge passed down from generation to generation to secure health for their community.
Yeah, that's a really good reminder. I think culturally around the world, mm-hmm. there's still a lot of traditional medicine. When you're out on the field and looking for medicinal properties of different plants, how do you decide on what has the potential to be bioactive. You know, I go out in my yard and everything looks not that different. I would have no idea of thinking which ones to bring back and analyze. Yeah. Like, how do you know what to look for when you're out in the field?
That's a great question. I would say that you need to get plant goggles, is what I call them. So this lens of knowing how to look at the natural world is so important. And interestingly, in medicine, I mean, in the past, most physicians and pharmacists were trained heavily in botany. That was really the foundation of biology for quite some time, and because it was so important to medical practice with compounding of medicines in the past. Today, the way that I determine which plants could be the most useful potentially for drug discovery is I work in tight collaboration with local communities that use these plants on a regular basis for medicine. So this involves a lot of anthropology. It's a lot of interviews with local people. We put forth collaborative agreements for access and benefit sharing with communities in different countries, and really just have open discussions, I mean, with these little old ladies in villages, and we're sitting down and we're talking about their health and about wild foods and about plants that they've used, plants that their grandmothers taught them how to use, and how they use them today to take care of their own family. And then in the field, we collect the plants. So we use rigorous techniques from botany to collect specimens. These are pressed, and we place these in a location called the herbarium. An herbarium is like a plant museum. It's a way that we keep track of which species are used for different things. And then in the lab, we bring back larger amounts of these plants. So if you can imagine like a grocery bag full of leaves that's used for a specific medicinal purpose. Those are brought back, they're dried down, and we pull out the chemicals from the plants and test them in our different laboratory models. But really, it all comes down to that local knowledge. Now, this summer, I'm really excited because we're going to be working here in Georgia in a beautiful longleaf pine habitat. Working here in the U.S. is a bit different from when I work in other countries because we really don't have that much intact botanical knowledge in place anymore. Old-timers are difficult to find now that still use medicinal plants for their health. So in this case, we're going back to historic records, and we're looking at the literature documenting the way that in the past Native American tribes like the Cherokee and Choctaw used to use medicinal plants of the Southeast for medical care. And so we've created a kind of shopping list to go through and find, you know, over 200 species that we have on our shopping list to find these in the woods. So that's what I'll be doing this summer.
That'll be a great adventure. You know, you touched on something that, you know, it's really an interesting point, and it's the regulatory environment around this because, if, you know, sitting down with the locals, mm-hmm. you know, these plants have been around for centuries, and when you discover the medicinal value, who owns the this compound to take it to market? Like, how's that decided?
Yeah, that's a really important concept. And there's been a lot of work in this space around the ethics of bioprospecting. There are two terms you should be aware of. One is biopiracy, which is, you can imagine, piracy is about stealing something. Bioprospecting, on the other hand, incorporates an ethical way of going about collecting plants. So I really view the communities and the people we work with as true collaborators in these initiatives. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done on the front end to set up collaborative agreements. And we work often very closely with local universities. So, for example, some of the ways that we are able to give back to communities and back to countries where we're working is to engage in access and benefit sharing from the get-go. So the drugs that we're trying to discover here, they may not actually come to mean anything for more than 20 years down the road. So how do I help today? Some of the ways that we work is we work with local students. So we've also engaged in exchange of students between countries and having students and even professors come and train in the laboratories here at Emory to learn more advanced techniques to bring back to their labs. We've also created botanical gardens in some of the communities and helped create curriculum for local teachers to teach students about plants that grow in their environment, but also to share back that knowledge that we documented. For me, it's really important to ensure that whatever knowledge we're taking out of a community that we're really documenting, that that knowledge is returned to the community in a way that's understandable to them. Giving them a copy of a scientific paper is great, but is that actually something that they're going to really understand and appreciate? So instead, what we've done, for example, in a community that I worked with in southern Italy, is I wrote a book in Italian and English, and I also had these ancient Albanian names of plants, because in this case, the community was a community of immigrants that came 5 centuries ago from Albania to Italy. So they spoke an endangered language. And so we wrote down all of the names of the plants, and we documented the ways that their grandparents had told us that they used them, and then gave that back to the community. And so it was really beautiful to see how now the next generation was able to share this with their children. And even if grandparents had passed on, their knowledge, their photos, their wisdom, their words were still there in that community. So for me, that's, I think, one of the most important first steps, is to go into these this kind of work with a real ethical and intentional mindset of how can I give back and how can I share with what they're sharing with us.
I think that is incredibly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think the ethics and how you're doing it makes it such that it is such a win-win for the community, for the world, and, mm-hmm. and all the knowledge that you gain from the local indigenous plants. And, you know, it takes so much extra effort and time, obviously, hearing all the different steps and things that you are thinking through in the process. But in the bigger picture, the contribution that's made from learning from these plants is just tremendous.
Yeah, and there's never been, I think, a more urgent time than now to document this knowledge. We're facing not only extinctions of species globally because of factors like climate change, deforestation, removal of huge tracts, for example, of the Amazon from logging and mining and oil and cattle farming, but we're also losing the people that live there, and not just the people, but also their culture and the languages that go within that. And when you lose a language and you lose that culture, there are just enormous libraries of knowledge that are also being lost about a lot of these resources from the world that we may never regain. And so I think that the job of ethnobotanists is incredibly important in ensuring, you know, in the future that we not only have access to resources for future medicines, but also for the future of our food. We actually consume a very small level of biodiversity on our plates today. We rely on very few varieties of foods. If you can think, for example, of how many different types of banana do you eat in a typical week? The answer for most people is one, because we only propagate the Cavendish banana, and it's clonally propagated. That means that it's genetically identical. Now, I love to use the example of the banana because it's also at risk. There's a fungus that's wiping out the bananas globally, and this particular strain of banana, it's called Tropical Race 4, that's wiping out the Cavendish. And so we can, when you have the same genetic or lack of genetic diversity within a food crop, they're very susceptible to plant pests. But if you go into a traditional community, they don't ever rely on one single genetic variant of a plant, of a food plant, or even of a medicinal plant. When they grow their crops, they often contain many different variations of that crop, or even wild species that aren't necessarily great tasting, but are more hardy and can survive a drought or survive insect attack or survive fungus and so on. And so it's through this way that they really actively try and support biological diversity in their food systems and also in their general ecosystem and sources of medicine as well. So there's a lot that we can learn from this.
Oh, there's so many dimensions to this. You know, mm-hmm. you're preserving the plants, you're preserving the tradition and culture that will, you know, potentially mm-hmm. die with the current generation of people, and you're preserving the biodiversity.
Yeah. I mean,
there's so many benefits, really, in kind of storing that knowledge and what nature already has.
Absolutely. And I think some of the most exciting work that botanists are doing today have to do with a lot of the global seed banking initiatives. So there's the they call it in the news the Doomsday Vault, but it's this vault that contains seeds. They're trying to collect seeds of every crop across the globe. But also now they're working on collecting, and many groups are working on collecting, wild crop relatives of species. So these are plants that are genetically related to the crops but could serve as resources for the development of better crops in the future that can deal with drought or deal with changes in heat or moisture and things in the environment. Now, I think an area that we could have some improvement, though, is improved recording of knowledge when it comes to the traditional knowledge of these wild crops or wild crop relatives. Because if you have a seed, how much more valuable would that seed be if you also knew from local custom under which conditions did you actually plant that
sure.
seed?
Yeah. Sure. So knowing what you know about the biodiversity and the real benefits of a lot of plants as medicine or especially as food, what advice would you have to us living in America, having the resources we have, which oftentimes are cloned in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, the lack of biodiversity? Like, but what dietary advice would you have if someone wanted to eat the healthiest that they could in our food environment?
Yeah, well, I think that the first step would be to really make an effort to eat locally and to eat within your season. A lot of our foods are shipped from across the globe. They're grown, and when it's deep winter in the Northeast, you can still get a ripe tomato. How is that possible? Well, it's because it's grown on the other side of the world and it's shipped. Now, the danger in that is that when plants are shipped or foods are shipped from such long distances, is that they're often harvested before they're ready to be harvested. And so if you've ever had that juicy, delicious taste in your mouth of a freshly vine-ripened tomato, you know there's a big difference between that and tomato that's been shipped across the globe and has been gassed to force it to turn red. And that difference that you taste is actually due to the plant's chemistry. Now, we know from our work in pharmacology that chemistry matters when it comes to food. So I often question, what is the health value of a food that's picked at the wrong time, shipped, and aged at a longer period than the food that you can collect locally and eat when it's really mature and ripe, when it's meant to be eaten? And so this is an area of science that requires more investigation. I think The other aspect is that you can take into your own hands is to try and do some gardening of your own. It's good for your mental health, I think, as well as your physical well-being. Even if you don't have a large plot of land to grow plants on, you can really grow successfully a number of culinary herbs or herbs that can be used in herbal teas. One of my personal favorites is that of Osimum basilicum, or holy basil. It grows really well here in Georgia. And in Ayurvedic medicine, it's known as tulsi. And it's just drunk typically for overall well-being. But there are a lot of different examples like that of plants that you can grow even on a balcony or in your kitchen to then incorporate into your diet, to have as a fresh way of incorporating health-benefiting herbs into your diet.
Yeah, and I love incorporating herbs. For someone who's trying to figure out what they should grow, mm-hmm. you know, you just gave a great example. But there are also a lot of plants that make claims that may not have value. How can a person kind of get on the path of learning which herbs and spices to use that truly are beneficial versus going down the path of maybe getting trapped into things that are really commercially promoted mm-hmm. but aren't as scientifically healthful?
Yeah, I think most of the dangers come across when you come into that area of problem is has to do with things that are marketed, especially things that are very expensive and marketed.
So there's an inverse correlation. The higher yeah. the price, the less the value.
So, I mean, one example is that of acai berry. Acai is actually the fruit of a palm tree that grows in the Amazon. What most people don't know is that local people actually consume the fruit as a regular part of their diet. They consume a different variant, though. They consume the green fruits, and we use these purple varieties in a lot of our acai formulations. So I always tease my students, you know, don't waste your money on the super smoothie across campus.
It's a superfood.
Superfood. Exactly.
Super food?
It's actually usually it tastes so good because they put a lot of sugar into it, which is not super good for you. I think that some of the best ways to get the benefits of these plants are to think about your colors. It's a very simple way. Color is also determined by chemistry. And so a lot of your health-benefiting compounds come from fruits and vegetables that are in dark purples and reds. This is why blueberries and bilberries and strawberries
are
great for you. Yeah. Exactly. And that antioxidant activity comes from the type of compounds that are typically found in those fruits.
Pigments.
So these are
sure.
the anthocyanins, your polyphenols. Those have what we call exogenous antioxidant properties. Here's another secret. Your body makes its own antioxidants on a regular basis. And you can supplement the levels of antioxidants by including these in your diet, but know that your body normally already makes a lot of antioxidants. It's kind of like you can only take so many vitamins, you know, before they kind of hit a threshold of what they can actually do and health benefit. I give a lecture on dietary antioxidants to my class, and the first thing that we begin with is we start with a discussion of how are free radicals generated? How are these harmful oxygen species generated that can cause damage to your tissues? And number one is we naturally generate these when our mitochondria or the energy factory houses within our cells leak these reactive oxygen species or free radicals into our body. But we also increase higher levels of them when we're exposed to pollution, when we're exposed to UV light, so sun, a lot of sun exposure, or radiation, smoking, alcohol. All of these things contribute to higher levels of these bad reactive oxygen species in your body. So every semester, I always have one student ask, well, what if I just eat a bunch of berries and I can go on spring break and drink and smoke and be in the sun? You know, can I counteract these effects? My advice is no. I think you should avoid the excessive exposure to the sun and smoking and alcohol and all these other things. But definitely do include these dark berries and dark leafy greens in your diet because it is good for your body. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. And the getting in the mix and the diversity of the fruits and vegetables, right? Because mm-hmm. each one has such unique antioxidants and unique
Absolutely.
Kind of phytochemicals or plant chemicals. So that diversity, yeah. you know, back to the student example, no, you cannot just eat a berry.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, what's important to note, too, is, like you said, not all antioxidants are made equal. Some are fat-soluble and some are water-soluble. So what does that mean when it comes to your body? Your body is made up of fats and waters and other tissues. And so these compounds can protect different parts of your body, perhaps better than others. So that diversity and having a mixture of different dark, you know, fruits and vegetables is really important. I also get a lot of questions about dietary supplements from people. My main advice is that any supplement that promises an immediate effect is typically not good for you. And this is especially a concern when it comes to people that are doing bodybuilding or are taking supplements for enhanced athletic performance. We've seen time and time again, there have been dangerous things added to some of those supplements, and the FDA does a pretty good job at regulating those and trying to remove those from the market. But what concerns me now is that we have an increasing persistence of stimulants in some supplements.
Mm-hmm.
So caffeine, but also related compounds to caffeine.
Like ephedra.
Yes, and ephedra, which is now banned for supplements, but caffeine is not. And any natural compound has the potential to be a poison or a medicine, right? So high levels of caffeine are not good for your body. It is not good for your heart to have high levels of stimulants, especially when compounded with exercise. Other things that concern me are supplements that make claims for male enhancement. And this is a really big issue across the country. These are sold often in gas stations, and they're called like herbal Viagra. These are also very dangerous. They've been shown time and time again that they actually are adulterated or purposely contaminated with pharmaceuticals like Viagra or compounds that look like Viagra but aren't quite Viagra. This is dangerous because it can also have adverse effects for your heart. Other supplements I would avoid are anything that promises rapid weight loss.
That's a big, yes, big area.
Yes, again, because of risk factors for the heart. So I think in general, those are your big warning signs. Anything with like a big immediate reaction for weight loss or muscle gain or to treat erectile dysfunction is generally something you should stay away with. Many of the other herbal supplements are probably completely fine for you to take. Personally, I don't take supplements. I try and incorporate my plants through my diet. We really try and use a lot of fresh herbs in our cooking, a lot of spices. You can get a lot of benefit from spices, even like black pepper. Believe it or not, a few centuries ago, black pepper was a rare spice that was considered a cure-all or a panacea by people. There are other spices like nutmeg that once were worth their weight in gold. I mean, we take for granted a lot of the access that we have to spices today that really were used as important medicines in the past, and that's because they do have important pharmacological properties on the body when taken in moderate amounts in the diet.
Yeah, that's such an important point that, you know, these natural compounds have so much value when they're consumed in their natural state.
Mm-hmm.
But when you concentrate them to 10x or 20x and put them in a pill, that's when you see these, you know, adverse health effects. You know,
yeah.
From my end as a physician, we see, you know, there's been a rising rate of emergency room visits just from supplements and, you know, liver function problems, et cetera. We're seeing the gamut. And it's not that these herbs are harmful. It's just when you concentrate them, take them out of their natural context and turn them into a pill,
yeah,
that they're no longer what that plant, you know, was designed to do.
Yeah, and that's not the way that they're consumed in traditional diets or in traditional medicine. So I always tell my students, you know, I've never seen a shaman take a leaf and grind it up into a pill and, you know.
And sell it?
Yeah, exactly. They're often consumed as teas, or they're steeped in alcohol to make tinctures, or they're prepared in different ways. But on the other hand, I do want to put this out there that plants definitely do have a lot of therapeutic potential, and we know that they do contain compounds that in many cases can have really important impacts on health. The science behind herbs, however, needs a lot of work because we really have only looked in depth at, you know, at most maybe a few hundred species. The Kew Gardens recently put out a report on the state of the world's plants, and one of the figures that they cited is that globally there are at least 28,000 plants that have been used or reported for use in traditional medicine. But when you look in the scientific literature, I can tell you that very few of those have actually been studied in depth. And so this is an area where I'm hoping that my lab can also make an important contribution, is to really understanding the safety of these medicinal plants, both for the benefit of the local people, but also for future benefit for a broader audience. If we can discover new chemistries from these plants to develop new pharmaceuticals, and also to understand how these work. I think one of the most exciting things about the research that we do is that by looking at these plants, we're starting to uncover new ways or new possible mechanisms through which to treat infectious disease. And I think that's probably, for me, is one of the most exciting things about my job every day.
Oh, and you know, you say that in such a humble way, but I know your work towards antibiotic resistance has such potential, you know, especially with myself being in the healthcare field, as such a threat to, you know, right now in all of medicine and healthcare.
Yeah.
We're trying to reduce prescribing antibiotics, but yeah, tell us more about what you've found in terms of potential for overcoming antibiotic resistance through plants.
Yeah, it's a great question. It is such a huge problem. I mean, just to put things in perspective for people, they estimate that 700,000 people die each year currently from antimicrobial resistant infections. And by the year 2050, we'll reach 10 million a year. So the numbers are really staggering, and we need solutions urgently. What we're doing with our work is trying to understand if and how these traditional remedies work. So when I'm out collecting plants and looking at the historic literature or interviewing people, I'm very interested in anything that has to do with pustulant infections. So I'm asking people about abscesses, non-healing wounds, burns, any kind of infectious disease, really, and trying to understand which plants they're using to mitigate those. And one good example of this is our work on the Brazilian pepper tree. So the Brazilian pepper tree, or Shinus terebinthifolia, is in the same family as the mango, right? And poison ivy, right? So it's an interesting plant family. And it has a long history of use. We found records in Latin going back to the 1600s that were recorded concerning the use of this in Brazilian medicine. And what was interesting is that they reported the use of the fruits in a poultice. So basically a poultice is when you pound up the fruits and apply it topically to the skin to an infected wound. And you have to remember, centuries ago, they had no concept of what germ theory was or that bacteria existed. This is a relatively new concept of what is germ theory. So all that they knew is that they pounded up these berries and put it on these you know, putrid flesh, and it got better. And so when you look at what was known in the literature about that plant, we found that there was no growth inhibition of bacteria reported. Most of our antibiotics work by either slowing down the growth or killing bacteria. And this did neither. So it was not a classic antibiotic. So we started asking other questions. And I think that's one of the greatest pearls of wisdom I can give to my students, is to really think about what are the right questions, because you can't make discoveries in science if you're not asking the right questions.
You can blow that off and say it doesn't have value instead of saying maybe I'm not looking at it the right way.
That's exactly what's been done with many, many plants, is it's an old wives' tale, doesn't work. Well, we started asking other questions. And one of the questions that we asked was, well, what other effects might it have on the way that bacteria behave? And one thing that's unique about bacteria is that they communicate with each other. You think about them. They're single-celled organisms, and yet somehow they have to coordinate group behavior to ensure their success in living in a certain ecosystem. And so they do this by releasing small molecules into the environment, and they recognize or they sense those molecules. So it's like they're, you know, using a chemical language to talk to one another and listen to one another. And when they reach a certain level of this language, or they're basically shouting in their environment, then they change their behavior and start behaving like a group. What was fascinating about the pepper tree extract is that we found that we were able to shut down that entire communication system. And so we were basically tricking the bacteria into behaving like they're alone, that they're not in a group, when in fact they were in a group. There were many bacteria cells growing around them. And so when they're tricked into behaving as single cells, they don't release toxins. And as a physician, you know that some of the greatest dangers of bacterial infection are all the toxins that they release, because that's what can actually burst open your blood cells or destroy your tissue or cause that big wound bed to develop. And so by blocking their communication, we're able to stop the toxins. We basically took away all of their weapons. And as a result, the immune system, in this case, we were doing work with mice, the immune system's able to clear out that infection. So it's a whole other way of re-envisioning the art of war with bacteria.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. So it's things like that. And we have other examples. We're looking at other plants that, instead of blocking their ability to make toxins, stop the ability of bacteria to stick to things or create biofilms. And this has great potential relevance for medical implant device infections.
Sure.
So I think that was kind of a really cool aha moment. You know, this is not an old wives' tale. This is really a unique, different way of addressing infection. Can you treat infection without actually using a drug to kill the bacteria? And this seems to be indicating that yes, we can.
Oh, which is, you know, just such a great way to think out of the box,
mm-hmm.
you know, of how we're approaching this whole antibiotic
yeah.
resistance issue. You know, we're almost out of time. I just want to kind of ask you your thoughts on where do you think the future is going with ethnobotany?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic because I know that there's a lot of student interest in ethnobotany, but I'm also a bit pessimistic because botany programs across the globe have really disappeared. We have seen the loss not only of botany courses in universities, but whole departments of botany. A lot of our botanical education and research has gone more the molecular route. and we're not really training the numbers of what we call plant taxonomists, or people that are able to systematically name and identify plants, we're not training in high enough numbers that next team of scientists. So I think that the field has huge relevance
and potential.
My hope is that, you know, that we'll be able to generate, along with the many other botanists that are doing amazing work from climate change to food security to medicinal research, to generate enough enthusiasm to really bring more botany back into the classroom. Because I think that's the major risk that we face here, is if we're not able to teach the next generation the fundamentals of botany, we're going to be in a bad spot.
Yeah, well, gosh, your work is incredible. So thank you so much for all the work that you do and for taking the time to talk to us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.